Egyptians have taken to the streets to protest their government for the third straight day. Hosni Mubarak has been the face of that government for nearly 30 years. On today's First Backstory, we look at President Mubarak's political career and find out what's led to this week's protests. And joining me now from Cairo are Heba Moraef, a researcher for Human Rights Watch, and Ashraf Khalil. He's a Cairo-based journalist who's been covering the protests for Foreign Policy magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to today's First Backstory segment. Hello.
Hello.
And what time is it now in Cairo?
8:30 at night.
Oh, okay. So we're not keeping you up. Heba?
No.
Why was Hosni Mubarak the man who succeeded Anwar Sadat in 1981? Had he worked to position himself as Sadat's successor?
I couldn't hear the question, sorry.
I was wondering how Hosni Mubarak became the man who succeeded Anwar Sadat in 1981 after Sadat had been assassinated.
As the vice president, Hosni Mubarak was in a key position to take over as Sadat's successor. It wasn't a democratic process. Mubarak was part of the same military regime that came to power in 1952. And as such, he continued in line with the overall repressive policies of his predecessors.
But Sadat was assassinated for signing a peace deal with Israel. Since Mubarak was part of that government, why was he not also considered part of that process?
Mubarak's policies towards the Islamists were different from Sadat's, which in turn was also different from Nasser's. Each of the presidents has had a different approach to them. Mubarak had to deal in the 1990s with Islamist organizations that used violence, but it also showed which he approached in an extremely repressive manner by arbitrarily arresting thousands, torturing, relying on state security trials, and all of this in the context of the emergency law, which he's continued to apply in Egypt since 1981 without interruption, arguing that Egypt has remained in a state of emergency since Sadat himself was shot, while at the same time saying that, you know, the violence of the 1990s is over due to his Ministry of Interior successors, and that Egypt is now stable and investment-friendly and tourist-friendly destination. Yet the emergency law remains in place, and that's the source of the biggest human rights repressions that we see today.
Ashraf, Mubarak began to describe the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist threat. At a certain point, hadn't they endorsed his presidential run in 1988?
Well, I mean, the Brotherhood has been in and out of, has had multiple political stances over the years. Currently, you know, whatever happened in their history, now they are pretty much trying to set themselves up as an opposition force, and have done so quite effectively. They proved their grassroots strength 5 years ago when they ran as independents, as technical independents in parliamentary elections because they're not allowed to have a political party. And they ended up becoming the largest opposition bloc in parliament. And so the question really regarding the Brotherhood is not whether they're never going to endorse Mubarak at this stage or support Mubarak at this stage, but it's a question of how confrontational are they willing to be? Are they willing to take to the streets as an organization? And they have proven that they can gather thousands on short notice. They have a formidable, disciplined grassroots organization. And one of the interesting things about the wave of protests that's happening now is that it's happening independently of the Brotherhood. Individual brothers are participating, but this happened outside of them.
Were the Brotherhood at all connected to the Islamic militants who were behind the assassination of Sadat?
That was a splinter group. It contained some former brothers. It's called the Islamic Group in English, and it was not the formal Brotherhood, but certainly they have been tarred by association with that, and the government has frequently kind of tried to tie all of that together. But it wasn't the Brotherhood.
Yeah, but the country has been in a declared state of emergency ever since Sadat's assassination. We're talking over 30 years, aren't we? What kind, or nearly 30 years, what kind of powers does that give the government?
It gives the government, specifically the security services, very, very broad powers to arrest arbitrarily, to detain without charge, and to detain people for unlimited periods of time. This is something, it was a tool that was used primarily against security detainees, but then became the natural tool to use against political dissidents. It allows the government to prohibit demonstrations and to justify the arrest of any demonstrators who insist on going onto the streets, even if they're demonstrating completely peacefully. It created these specialized courts that allows the government to have political trials against, historically against peaceful political opponents, as well as in security cases. But more than that, and this is what we're really concerned about as a human rights organization, it's created a culture where state security investigations are above the law because constitutional guarantees in the Egyptian constitution are no longer applied in the light of the emergency law. And these security officers become this all-powerful body which controls political space and which are very effective at deterring Egyptians with, you know, fear of arrest and obviously fear of systematic torture, which remains very much a concern today in Egypt.
Didn't Mubarak extend the state of emergency for another 2 years last May? So it's in effect right now.
Yes, it's in effect right now. In 2005, for the first time, Mubarak made a concession during the elections and said that he would end the state of emergency. Despite this commitment to end it, since then, Mubarak has renewed it further on the fervor two occasions. And right now, the state of emergency will remain in place until 2012, which will safely see us through this year when presidential elections are scheduled to take place in September.
My guests are Heba Mariaf, a researcher for Human Rights Watch in Cairo, and also in Cairo, Ashraf Khalil, a Cairo-based journalist. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Egypt is a very poor country, but the poverty seems to have gotten worse in recent years. Is that one of the reasons we're starting to see widespread dissatisfaction?
Sure, I'll take that if that's okay. What you're seeing, the poverty has remained about the same. The problem is that the cost of living has gone up. And at the same time as that is happening, the gap between rich and poor has become much more pronounced. The top 10% or so are prospering so obviously that it really sharpens the dynamic between rich and poor and sharpens the awareness of that. So probably the poor in Egypt are just as poor as they were 10 years ago, but it's that much harder for them to make ends meet, and they're seeing, you know, someone is prospering here, and they see that. It's becoming very, very blatant, that gap. And that frustration is fueling a portion of these protests.
Well, in 2005, Mubarak won a fifth term in office, and there were protests then. He's announced that he's going to run for a sixth term, if I understand correctly. But how do these protests compare to
what... He has not announced that yet.
He hasn't
formally come out and said, I will. Members of his party have said that he is the obvious choice, but he has not said the words yet.
Well, how do these protests compare to the ones we saw before? And are the things that people are complaining about similar? Heba?
The things that people are complaining about, it's a mixture, a lot like Tunisia. It's a mixture of economic and political grievances. You're getting, you know, there are people that just want more job opportunity. They want to see some of the benefits of this foreign investment that Egypt has drawn. They want to prosper the way that they see others around them prospering. And then there are protesters who are, you know, middle class and up, decently well off, and they want political changes. They want political freedom. They want greater freedom of expression. They want to see an end to the emergency law. They want an end to the police state. That is a real sticking point for people regardless of class. You asked another question about how this compares.
Yeah.
From everything I've heard, these are the largest protests. The only thing you can compare it to is 1977 in what is known as the Bread Riots, when, also driven by economic concerns, a rise in the price of subsidized bread caused clashes and protests so extensive that the army had to be called out.
That was when Sadat was in power.
That was under Sadat in 1977.
Go ahead, Heba.
I'm sorry. No, but I think one other interesting comparison is it was in 2003, which was the big protest at the time of the beginning of the Iraq War, the last time such a significant number of protesters, 6,000 or 8,000, managed to take over the central square, which is always the goal of protesters because of the 77 bread riots. But what is significant about last Tuesday is that this is the first time an exclusively anti-Mubarak protest has drawn in such significant numbers. Historically, you know, protests have been about foreign policy issues to do with the region, but never so clearly political and so clearly against the government. And I think that's the heartening message to take from last Tuesday, that people are really willing to take the risks and to say it straightforward that they don't want this government to continue. The socioeconomic protests that we've seen increasingly over the last 3 years, the labor protests, have been very specific, very limited to a set of specific demands. And when those are met, the protest, the strike, the sit-in very often ends. And that movement hasn't really fed into a broader political movement. There hasn't been that meeting point between political activists and people who are more broadly angry at the situation in Egypt today, and people who are really suffering the brunt of the economic policies of this government, which doesn't take poverty and the needs of the most disempowered into account.
Well, it's estimated that 90,000 people protested on Tuesday. You were there, Ashraf. What was the atmosphere like, and how did the police respond?
It was interesting. As the day began, and it started out as multiple protests kind of flowing around the city, sometimes joining up with each other. It was an amazing moment where I was walking with a group of about 150 protesters. They're walking towards Tahrir Square. This is well before the protests took over the square. And coming from the other direction is a much larger protest. And they sort of met up in the middle of the street and started cheering and hugging each other and then went on a different direction. At the beginning, you could tell that the police had been told to take it easy. They didn't have their billy clubs out. There wasn't tear gas. They didn't have their usual riot gear. And they were overmatched. I watched police outside the Cairo Supreme Court kind of just sort of locking arms and trying to hold on and hold their position in the street and just getting overwhelmed. And it wasn't until later on in the day when the protesters pushed them out of Tahrir Square that the tear gas came out, the billy clubs came out, all the equipment, the riot control, the crowd control equipment that Egyptians are so familiar with came out. So I think they had been told to give it a soft touch, perhaps with Tunisia in mind, and they lost. And that's when the heavy artillery came out.
Well, it is being reported that they're using rubber bullets now. Do you get a sense that Egyptians have been encouraged by what they've seen happen in Tunisia, or would these protests have happened anyway?
I'll take this if you don't mind. I think I can fairly say that what's happening now would not have happened if not for Tunisia. There have been protests. There have been, you know, what's happening is a combination of things. Tunisia was an inspiration, and I don't think this happens without Tunisia. But you have had a number of pockets of dissatisfaction that have produced protests. You've had a rising labor movement. You had a very angry blue-collar labor force. You've had serious protests last year over police brutality. There was an infamous case of a young man in Alexandria who was basically beaten to death by police in public in front of witnesses by plainclothes police officers. And he became a rallying cry because the issue of police brutality, the issue of the way that the emergency law has allowed the police to basically do whatever they want for decades, is a huge sore spot with Egyptians of all social classes. So that was a pocket of unhappiness. The labor activists are a pocket of unhappiness. The general youth movement, and it's all kind of coalescing.
And meanwhile, we see other things happening, like the bombing of the Coptic church in Alexandria. So the country seems to be in a bit of turmoil. Are these all connected, or are we just seeing one kind of act of violence here and then a protest there? The 300 people were arrested in Suez. There were also clashes between police and protesters in the city of Islamia.
I'll tell you, I interviewed Mohammed al-Baradei, the former IAEA chief who's now trying to launch a domestic reform campaign here.
He just arrived in Egypt. He's in Egypt now.
He just arrived within the hour. He has arrived back in Egypt. Although this movement also kind of happened independently of him, so I don't know that the protesters are sitting around waiting for him to lead them to the promised land.
Is he trying to position himself?
You know, there's that element among the protesters as well. It's very easy to find someone to say that. But I was talking to Baradei, and I asked him about the Muslim Christian stuff, and he said that it's a sign of a failing regime. It's a sign of a society that is in decline because it's been driven to ruin by this government. Those are, that's paraphrasing his words. And you can look at the labor activism from that point of view. You can look at the angry response to issues of police brutality, and that it's all, it's an old regime. You know, they've been at this for a while, and people are frustrated.
Heba, there has been global pressure on Mubarak to enact various political reforms, and the government has said that it's open to dialogue with the public, but has offered no concessions and hasn't issued any proposals to deal with political change. Do you think that this is just more of the same thing? We'll get through it and return to the way things were before all of these protests started?
A potential turning point in the sense that the government really does need to realize that it has to take these numbers seriously, and it has to take the consistent message sent out by these numbers seriously. The government has never historically responded to protests, angry protests, by revising or reconsidering any of its policies. It just doesn't react in that way. The Coptic protests at the beginning of January are a good example. A year ago, there was a drive-by shooting in Naga Hammadi at Christmas Eve when six Copts were killed on their way out of a Christmas mass. That was a wake-up call and caused a lot of public debate. And the government revived, a discussion about changing discriminatory laws that don't allow Christians to renovate or construct churches. And yet one year later, there's been no movement on that law. And then this bomb happens, and all of the built-up anger at the failure of the government to address discriminatory laws, the failure to properly investigate and prosecute incidents of sectarian violence between Muslim and Coptic communities, all of this boiled into days and days of demonstrations by thousands of young, angry Copts. And yet, even then, the government has not announced a change in any of its policy decisions. This is on one very specific issue where the government is already aware of the gravity of the problem. More broadly speaking, politically, I don't see in the short term a turnaround from the government on the various political issues that protesters this week have been demanding. But I think this could be a turning point in terms of how seriously they start taking the Egyptian people as a constituency that they need to perhaps listen to. And I think Tunisia was a good lesson for Arab leaders as well as an inspiration for Egyptian protesters.
Is the United States in something of a bind here? On the one hand, Hillary Clinton is saying that the government should not shut down Twitter or disrupt any cell networks during the protests, is calling for them to allow peaceful protests to continue. On the other hand, Mubarak is our friend in the Middle East, a recipient of a lot of foreign aid. What happens if Mubarak goes? Khalil?
I think the Egyptian government has quite...
Go ahead.
I think the Egyptian government has quite successfully presented itself to the West as the only stable option in Egypt. And I think for too long, the only option for stability, and has presented the Muslim Brotherhood as a fanatic Islamic group that will take over in Egypt and turn Egypt into Iran. And I am hoping that that card no longer resonates as strongly in the West. You have to support us as a repressive security state, or else Egypt will go to ruin, is a narrative that is very limited and very outdated. And I think that's another myth that I'm hoping this week can somewhat begin to dispel, because we need to see beyond this. And so the United States, which has given so much money and so much political support to the Mubarak government over the years, meanwhile being very well aware of the human rights violations that are ongoing, the more Egypt feels that it's supported and that it doesn't need to worry about any conditioning of that support or any increase in political pressure for reform, the more it becomes difficult for human rights defenders and political activists inside Egypt to fight their battles. And that's why I think governments like the United States that give so much money to Egypt have an obligation, at the very minimum, not to support repression, and beyond that, to also provide the political cover to create the space to allow Egyptians to make decisions about the
Ashraf,
future of the country.
Ashraf, how have this week's events been reported in the Egyptian media, or have people been relying on regional news outlets to get the news, like Al Jazeera?
I think Al Jazeera has been pivotal, certainly, but it has been widely reported. In the independent press, I mean, the tone is different between the independent press and the state-owned press. I actually just wrote something for the Times of London that talked about how maybe 10 years ago, before there was such an independent press, before there was independent satellite channels, before there was Twitter, the state media might have reported this very differently, would have really tried to shape or mutate the narrative. Here, it's much more subtle. They have to report on it. They have to say it's happening because it's happening and everybody knows about it. But there are subtle, you know, the little evidence of, especially in the state press, you know, there's calls for stability, and, you know, whatever anyone from the government says is given precedence for any statement is printed unchallenged. The casualty figures, even if you'll notice in the state press here, the casualty figures, they talk about how many policemen were injured, and then they talk about how many protesters were injured. And there's this constant emphasis, and they've had to become more subtle. As far as the independent press, they're really going to town with this. The Day of Rage is, you know, in huge red letters and across several newspapers in the last couple of days. So one of the things that makes this different than Tunisia is the independent press. So that's a dynamic that I think Egyptians are generally getting a fairly accurate narrative of events. If they're only reading the state press, then maybe they're not, but other options are available. Jazeera is a major conduit, but the independent satellite channels, there's a lot of media here, a lot of local media.
Thank you both so much for talking with us. Ashraf Khalil has been covering the protests in Egypt for Foreign Policy magazine. Heba Mariaf is a researcher for Human Rights Watch, also stationed in Cairo.